Elisabetta's favourite, Roberto Dovero. Rossini wrote about Elisabetta, the Regina d'Inghilterra, and Bellini about English Puritans. Two men who inspired a lot of history operas in 19th century Europe were Sir Walter Scott and Friedrich Schiller. I asked Roderick Swanston about how they packaged up history to make it attractive to composers.
Sir Walter Scott is a very interesting example of how people treated an author. I suppose what he gave composers a good deal to do with is, A, they could still portray characters. They could still portray lovelorn characters like Lucia de Lammermoor, based again on a Scott novel. But they could also incorporate into that, as for instance William Tell by Rossini, with lots of local colour. So I suppose in one sense what Walter Scott did for them was to give a repertoire of characters that they could draw on, and of a good deal of kind of daring do, lots and lots of running around and battle scenes, whereas classical tragedy, which had been based on ancient tragedy, didn't want to include battle scenes on the stage. I think the other thing about it is that Scott, taking a particular view of history, started including real historical characters like Quentin Durward. And as a result of that, along with people like Schiller, the German playwright on which many operas are based, introduced a confrontation between Mary, Queen of Scots, and Queen Elizabeth I, a confrontation which never took place, but which they felt ought to have taken place. And that's certainly true of when you set things like Ivanhoe and others in the Crusades. They didn't bother to check the facts of the Crusades. They simply became heroic characters against good, against evil, and these other elements.
So where do we place Wagner and his unusual choice of subject matter in all this?
Interestingly, when Wagner went to Paris, he set a historical story in the shape of Rienzi. And this was certainly to cash in on, to put it in its worst way, on the kind of thing which had been popular in Paris with Les Huguenots and the Prophète and so on. Real stories, even out of history, even though the foreground characters or the way they behaved certainly wasn't necessarily historically accurate. But Wagner, I think, began to feel that you couldn't tell the more general things about greed, about love, about renunciation, redemption and so on, through the means of real characters. And he was inspired in this, really, by both Hegel, but in particular by Schopenhauer. These people were, in a sense, puppets of the various human conditions and the human outcomes of actions and so on. And so what he particularly became interested in doing is to present them in mythological terms. And in this, of course, he harks back, ironically, to Aristotle, who makes a distinction between history and between myth. And the great thing about myth is that it's grander than history, it's bigger than history. It's not untrue, but it's more than true. It's universally true. So you can't live next to Tristan and Isolde. But what they suffer is part of the human condition.
And it's also true that at the same time as opera was moving away from history to the rediscovery of myth, it also began, certainly towards the end of the 19th century, to make serious efforts towards putting real life on stage.
I suppose one of the most interesting things of the development is away from history towards a documentation of modern life. Could you actually put what's happening in the world today on the stage and make it realistic? And I suppose in some ways the trailblazing opera for these is La Traviata. One of the things that Verdi was most worried about, or his censors and others, is how close to the bone it really was. It's still a big issue in La Traviata. She may be consumptive, but what she partly suffers from is the snobbery of her future father-in-law to save the face of his daughter, who wants to marry socio-economic group one and finds that the son would disgrace that and make that impossible by marrying La Traviata, Violetta. The great thing about that, of course, is that that must have been a contemporary problem of France. It's an expose of contemporary values. Opera must be able to address contemporary issues. I mean, it certainly does with the relationship of power, of seduction, of betrayal that you find in something like Tosca. Or you find the relation between different cultures you find in Madame Butterfly and so on. Now, I think in all these, it became a way of saying that opera is not irrelevant. It isn't something of a museum subject where you simply have to talk about things in the past and people have to extract from that in the audience what general message they should have. Now we can have opera as a way of interpreting and explaining some contemporary issues.
Are we finally then putting real life as the subject of opera on stage?
We aren't always putting real life on the stage. Sometimes we are. I mean, the options are always open to modern composers. They can set like Nixon in China, a real story made up of some documentation and so on. On the other hand, you can still have a mythological story. The Minotaur, for instance, of Bert Whistler is still a mythological story, but still raising perennial issues. What opera does best is to extract from the everyday life those general things and charge them with the power of music.
But does this mean that opera can now be about anything? Shirley Apthorpe is a European music critic for the Financial Times who has sat through a lot of 20th and 21st century opera. I asked her if she could see any themes that link the subject matter of modern opera.
I personally can't really see anything that does. If I sit down and think of all the new operas I've seen and operas that are known of in the 20th century, I find them so extraordinarily diverse that it's utterly impossible to detect any one common thread in subject matter, or even any two or three or five common threads. There seem to be almost as many subject matters as there are operas in the 20th century.
And why do you think that is?
I think that the course of history in the 20th century was so violent and so extreme and so fragmented itself that it had an inevitable impact on the artistic output of people writing through those turbulent times. I think in particular there was hardly any other time when the nature of a political event like the Second World War had such a major impact on the way people thought of art forms. We had Theodor Adorno, the philosopher, saying there can be no poetry after Auschwitz. That was one statement which summed up a lot of the attitude that led to things like the Darmstadt School of Composition, very hardcore modernism in Germany on the one hand, and then completely different reactions in America when many of the composers went on in entirely different directions.
What about the individual? He does seem to rise as a character in 20th century opera, either operas about loners or operas about individuals versus society. Do you think there's a development of the individual as a subject matter for opera?
You can certainly see some composers following that line of thought. Benjamin Britten is an obvious case with Peter Grimes and Billy Budd, Death in Venice. I think the perception of individuals is also something that you could argue is a political consequence. Also in Germany, protagonists want to move quickly away from mass hysteria questions of mass movement towards individuals. I think an interesting case also is Carl Amadeus Hartmann's Simplicius Simplicissimus, which is an opera about a simpleton in time of war. He was setting his opera in the time of the 30 Years' War, but it was clearly a play on the events happening around him during the Second World War. There are many operas about loners, but there are equally many operas about groups, about societies, about events in the 20th century.
If you say that operas can be about as many things as the composers want them to be about, where do we place John Adams and something like Nixon in China in that very wide panoply of subject matter?
I think Nixon in China is an oddity because it's such an overtly political theme, not just an overtly political theme, but a political theme taken out of the day before yesterday's politics. I remember when I first heard the title of the opera, I thought it was a joke. I thought, this can't be real. Has someone really written about something that recent? There are not many operas that try to put such contemporary politics onto the opera stage. I was trying to think of parallels. There was a rather prophetic little opera done in Berlin by the Neukölln Oper about Angela Merkel and her squabbles with Stoiber, which actually was created before she became Chancellor of Germany, and that's enjoying quite a comeback recently. Bongani Ndodona in South Africa has written an opera about Winnie Mandela. But on the whole, opera composers tend to strive for a little more distance between themselves and the subject matters of the operas, maybe in search of a more epic or a more arm's length quality.
Maybe it comes down to this. While composers, from Monteverdi to Giuseppe Verdi, were still concerned to give audiences what they wanted, the subject matter of opera reflected the tastes and obsessions of the time in which it was composed. But as operas become less populist, composers have felt free to pursue their own interests, however esoteric. The modern West End musical chooses its subject matter to reflect popular taste. Opera doesn't seem to feel that obligation. Shirley Apthorpe.
I would argue that different composers in different countries feel a completely different kinds of obligation to please their audience or to write works which easily take their audiences with them. I think in America, on the one hand, you have composers like Carlo Floyd and Giancarlo Menotti, whose operas did and do continue to please audiences. They're easy to follow, they're easy to hear. Other US composers like Philip Glass, Steve Reich, and John Adams, in fact, whose subject matters are maybe more challenging, but they still have a cinematic kind of flow of development in the way they treat their subject matter. Then on the other end of the extremes, you have Elliot Carter, who arguably is an American composer who is closer to what's happening in Central Europe. This is a line of development where subject matter begins to erode in itself completely. If you look at something like Elliot Carter's What's Next, that's an opera to an extent about life after death, maybe, maybe not. It's an opera so complex and so ambivalent in its synopsis that it's hard to really define the subject matter. The same could be said for Wolfgang Riem's Dionysus, which premiered at last year's Salzburg Festival and has gone on to Berlin. The content is based around Nietzsche, around Nietzsche's thoughts about Dionysus, but it's so cerebral that for the uninitiated listener, it's quite hard to say what exactly the subject matter is. And I think this kind of new ambivalence, where the listener, the viewer, is obliged to engage their brain and create, if you will, their own subject matter for the piece that they're listening to, is one of the newest trends in contemporary opera.
So who knows where opera is going now? As the art form enters its fifth century, there's greater individuality of style and subject matter than ever before. Back in the 17th century, opera embarked on a voyage of discovery, and it's still travelling today. We can only look forward to what happens next.
Opera journalist Adrian Moby, joined by Dr. Suzanne Abston, Roderick Swanston, and Shirley Apthorpe in that edition of 20 Minutes. And you're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And this is Andrew McGregor live in the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's Proms performance of the opera Nixon in China, conducted by its composer, John Adams. The latest news from the promenaders in the arena as to the money they've been collecting for musical charities has just gone out. We've already witnessed the spectacular news event beamed all over the world as the Nixons arrived in Peking in 1972. The meetings and greetings, the official banquets, the walkabouts and entertainments. But the opera's last act takes us to a different, darker place. Act 3 opens on the American visitors' last night in Peking. It's a single scene with no chorus, and director Peter Sellers imagined a communal bedroom with all of the main characters appearing on stage together for the first time, each in their own bed. President Nixon is very, very tired and looks it. The First Lady seems fragile and heavily made up. Madam Mao is smaller than she'd seemed to us before, and Premier Zhou Enlai is old and worn out. Only Chairman Mao is at his best, youthfully preserved in the portrait that hangs on the wall. Kissinger's impatience is obvious. Madam Mao doesn't like the music and changes it to her tune. She dances, and Chairman Mao steps down from the picture to relive the way they used to dance together when they were younger. The characters reminisce about their former lives, the Nixons scraping together the money to start a family home, Mao remembering when the tasty little starlet Jiang Qing, now Madam Mao, first arrived at his headquarters. Memories of love and lust, war and idealism. The long march, poverty, starvation. Then the Mao's concern that the revolution mustn't end, mixing with the Nixons' memories of food and drink for fighter pilots and free market capitalism where the customer is king. They all get into their beds, and it's left to the insomniac Premier Zhou Enlai to wonder out loud what it's all been for, as everything seems about to move beyond their grasp, perhaps to some kind of new dawn.
When we get to this short last act, which is kind of poignant, and it seems to remind me that after all the noise of self-promotion and of the glad-handing and coarseness of politics, that everyone has to go home and take off one's clothes and get into bed and be alone. And that can be a profound and at times disturbing and ultimately very elegiac and sad moment.
Composer John Adams, he's also tonight's conductor, of course. And Peter Sellers told me back in 2000, when Nixon in China first came to London, that in the opera's last act, he saw the beds on stage as coffins, the characters' final resting places. And he was remembering the way dead leaders lie in state in communist countries, sometimes for decades, just lying there and watching history pass by without them. So you get this strange hospital atmosphere, he told me, a strange end of days feeling, and a strange eternal dusk, which may actually be a dawn. a very Peter Sellers kind of thing to say. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra is conducted by John Adams, led this evening by Laura Samuel, who's just tuned the orchestra. Peter Sellers' view of that last act also had to carry a lot of other things as well. He told me that he felt the stain of Watergate the next year was already appearing from the shadows in this last act, and aging and decomposition is what it's all about. What the last generation did is already falling apart. The establishment is always disestablished. And to conduct the third act, the final act of Nixon in China, here comes John Adams and the members of the cast. And he's getting the saxophone section of the BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet for a special round of applause at the beginning before the rest of the orchestra. So it's the last night of the Americans' visit to Peking. The mood is somber. The music is not to everyone's taste.
Satisfied. That's what I tell them. They can't say you didn't tell them. It's no good. All that I say is misconstrued. Your lipstick's crooked.
Is it? Isn't much that I can do, is there? Who's in my handkerchief?
Please accept mine.
I find enough.
She like the people's choice.
Now for a solo on the spoons.
I like it when they play our tunes.
Thank you. fight, we die. And if we do not fight, we die.
That's how it goes.
I am alone. Give me a cigarette.
Come down, give me your hand, old man.
Why not?
Premier, please. Where's the toilet? Through the door. Excuse me for one moment, please. We saw apparent nakedness.
Till it screamed. There was the rent. There were those damned slip covers. And the groceries.
You made that place a home.
That place was heaven next to this.
There was
if they'd written off the debt. In Yenang, we were just boys.
Revolution is a boy's game. It's a boy's game.
I have
there was so much
and done.
There was so much
work
I could not tell.
Such as, such as.
Sitting around the radio with the enlisted men, I knew my time had come. The signal cleared, transmitting nothing like a word. There was a cross round one guy's neck. I noticed that.
You told me, Dick.
The corrugated metal roof shook with rain. The men were safe. I said goodbye to you then, Pat.
Did you?
Then I began to wait. The rain seeped in under the door. The lights went out.
You told me, dear.
That was the time I should have died.
Let us examine what you did. We led a quiet life. We grew stronger. We walked behind the plow. And as we worked year after year, the yellow dust that filled the air softened the Buddha's well-known face. Seem like one of us.
We made world records.
The taste is still in my mouth.
realized the Jap bombers had given us a miss.
Then come in for that.
And I went out. Already it was getting hot. A cloud of steam rose from the base, just like a Roman sacrifice.
I never doubted you'd come back.
I felt so weak.
I always knew.
I felt so weak with disappointment and relief.
I never doubted you'd come back.
Everything seemed larger than life.
I always knew.
sweat and soaked my uniform.
I
began to take in all the sights.
You
picture a thousand coconuts, bright men with heads, native masks, milk oozing from their broken husks. A flooded rib of a palm frond where several centipedes had found it. Unsanded wood that smelled like meat. Jesus, it grabbed you by the throat.
What I was doing there to the singer. As if you'd walk in at any moment they took off their
clothes. War was dislocated.
We recoil for victory and all its works. What do you think of that, Harlot? Speak up!
System, five card stud, taught me a lot about mankind. Speak softly and don't show your hand, became my motto.
Tell me more.
Well, the Pacific Theater was not much to write home about.
Yes, dear, I think you taught me that. I read it while
I was Nick. I must have told you that. Christ, it was beautiful. I swapped Span the hand of the meat and roped in a few men to biggest hand. My way of saying thanks.
Thank you. work. Outside this room, the chill of grace lies heavy.
Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai musing on sleeplessness, mortality, old age, and the way power seems eventually to move beyond the grasp of the political players we've been watching on stage in this BBC France performance of the opera Nixon in China. The first major collaboration between composer John Adams, librettist Alice Goodman, and director Peter Sellers, who suggested the subject of the opera to John Adams in the first place, just 11 years after they'd watched the television pictures of the Nixon's arrival in Peking. That performance, conducted live here at the BBC Proms by the composer John Adams. And as the huge audience here in the Royal Albert Hall applauds, we welcome back onto the stage the singers whose voices you didn't hear in that last act, the members of the BBC Singers. Chorus Master Matthew Morley leading their bow. They played the Chinese soldiers, workers, photographers, whatever was required of them, including handling the arrival of the presidential jets right at the beginning of the opera. Applause there for our three mezzos, Mao's three secretaries, the three women of the second act, Stephanie Marshall, Louise Poole, and Susan Platts. And here comes Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, sung by bass baritone James Rutherford. That applause, those cheers for Madame Mao, soprano Kathleen Kim. He's turning to applaud the orchestra and the chorus. And here comes Gerald Finley, Premier Zhou Enlai, whose musings we heard ending the opera. And here's the First Lady, Pat Nixon, dressed all in red, soprano Jessica Rivera, curtsying to the audience here in the hall, blowing kisses for the rest of the cast. And Chairman Mao stepping once again from his virtual portrait. Alan Oak, Here he comes, trotting onto the stage. President Richard Nixon, almost to the life in this portrayal by baritone Robert Orr in the famous V for Victory symbol flashed by him to the promenaders. The cast links hands, they all bow low. I think we're only missing the composer. Where's John Adams? The BBC Symphony Orchestra, of course, led by Laura Samuel. You heard her playing the violin solos at the end there, along with viola player Norbert Blumer, cellist Susan Monks, and that, of course, is the huge roar that welcomes composer and conductor John Adams back to the platform. Kisses Laura Samuel on both cheeks, shakes hands with other members of the orchestra, does a huge thumbs up to the BBC singers. Well, for John Adams, it must be hard to believe it's now 25 years since the first performance of Nixon in China in Houston in 1987, and a full 40 years since the momentous events that inspired it. John, over the years, has made many friends here at the Royal Albert Hall in Proms performances, and from the sound of it, I think a lot of them are here with us tonight. But we're always among friends back in Broadcasting House, where James Jolly is waiting for us.
Thank you, Andrew. That was Andrew McGregor. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, when Bernard Haitink conducts the Vienna Philharmonic in Beethoven, his fourth piano concerto, with Murray Pariah and Bruckner, his ninth symphony. Well, we've a little time before the essay at 11:15, so here are the Vienna Philharmonic 1958 vintage in Johann Strauss the Younger's overture to Die Fledermaus. Rudolf Kemper conducts.
Thank you.
The overture to Johann Strauss II's Die Fledermaus, the Vienna Philharmonic, were conducted by Rudolf Kemper. And you can catch the Vienna Phil in tomorrow evening's prom at 7. Now here's Petrarch Trelawney with a few words about breakfast.
It might be a piece of music that you grew up with. Might be a piece of music you chose to be performed at your wedding or at a friend's party. Might be something taught to you by a beloved piano teacher. Perhaps the first piece of music you heard live in concert. Whatever it is, we'd like you to tell us about it on Your Call. Your Call is a daily part of breakfast on BBC Radio 3. It's very simple. We talk to listeners on the air, on the phone, just for a couple of minutes and get them to tell us why a particular piece of music is so special to them. What piece of music would you choose? We'd love to hear from you. Threebreakfast@bbc.co.uk. Tell us the piece of music that you choose for Your Call and be part of breakfast 7 days a week here on BBC Radio 3.
Now, you may well have listened to the prom earlier this evening, but did you listen with the fastidious attention of all your faculties? And did you consult the programme notes? Musical historian Richard Witz explores the music appreciation movement, which grew up in the early 20th century.
When the writer Aldous Huxley went to concerts, there was one feature there that was sure to annoy him. In his essay of 1931, Music at Night, he writes, "What does music say? You can buy at almost any concert an analytical programme that tells you exactly. Much too exactly. That is the trouble." He goes on, "Some critics have protested that music and painting signify nothing but themselves, that the only things they say are things, for example, about modulations and fugues. If the purists were right, then we should have to regard painters and musicians as monsters. For it is strictly impossible to be a human being and not have views of some kind about the universe at large. Very difficult to be a human being and not to express those views. Music says things about the world, but in specifically musical terms. If we want to know, we must listen." So, the programme note is claimed here to be a bookish hindrance to music appreciation, where listening is the imperative task of the listener. And Huxley's own view of music stands against that formalism at the heart of the music appreciation tradition. Its aesthetic core relied on the principle that music was autonomous. It stood alone in what it meant. Yet programme notes pioneered music appreciation. They did so in the sense of giving context to the musical experience. In this country, programme notes were born in Edinburgh University. A chair of music had been started there by General Reed. Reed was a military officer, a composer and flautist in the style of Frederick the Great. He'd made the bequest on condition that a concert would be held every year on his birthday. Edinburgh's first Reed professor, John Thompson, launched these concerts in 1841 with programme notes. He gave biographical details of the composers together with a technical account of the works. In London, the Musical Union took up Thompson's idea, calling them synoptical analyses. From the 1860s onwards, the programme, or book of words, became a regular feature. They became rather sophisticated in design, some printed on silk so the pages wouldn't make a sound when they were turned. What tended to be written on the silk followed the formalistic tone of the time, stressing music's self-sufficiency, or how it transforms, say, a poem. So, programme notes were founded in Scotland, and the very best of them were written there too. But they were only Scottish. They were penned by the English pianist, composer and conductor Donald Francis Tovey. He was Edinburgh's Reed Professor from 1914 to his death in 1940. Tovey turned his programme notes into radio programmes. At the same time, Oxford University Press turned them into six celebrated books, The Essays in Musical Analysis. They're still highly admired for their insight and style, deep thoughts about music spread about in an almost casual fashion. Tovey claimed that the duty of the writer of programme notes was that of counsel for the defence. All that could be said in favour of the work had to be included. The note should do its best to make sure that the work would be played again, better. In general, Tovey takes an approach that we tend to call experiential analysis. He uses words and short music examples to show where we are, what has happened, and how elements we have heard are connected up. So his analysis normally takes the shape of a journey through time, in stages from the beginning to the end of a piece. Funnily enough, time was his biggest problem in the BBC studio. He often overran and was cut off, while a frustrated band sat next to him giving him signals with his fingers, and we can imagine sometimes what kind. But Tovey's time-based method was poles apart from that of his German rival, Heinrich Schenker. Schenker analysed music spatially. Rather than words, Schenker used graphic notation to compress pieces of music. He did so in order to display what he considered to be the essential unity within a work, while Tovey was just as interested in its variety. Later on, under the influence of the neo-modernism of the 1950s, the metaphysical Schenker appealed to analysts of music who enjoyed drawing charts on blackboards like it was physics. But Tovey, with his whimsical references to Shakespeare and Dickens, found favour again once postmodernism kicked in by the 1980s. After all, he wrote his programme notes not for the specialist, but what Walford Davis had called the ordinary listener. In the 20s, Tovey improvised for his ordinary listeners rambling but popular classes at the Workers' Education Association. He wrote most of his notes for the local Edinburgh public of the symphony and chamber concerts that he organised at the Usher Hall there. One of his audience might well have been Miss Jean Brodie in her prime. Brodie's creator, Muriel Spark, tells us in her autobiography that it was the teacher on whom she based Miss Brodie who was indeed the Tovey regular. Before Tovey arrived in Edinburgh, he gained a formidable reputation across Europe as a thinking man's recitalist. He toured internationally as a pianist with virtuosi such as the cellist Casals and the violinist Joachim, a friend of Brahms. And it emerges from Tovey's letters around this time that his exemplar was that of Robert Schumann. Schumann had developed the status of animateur as a composer, pianist, municipal music director, writer and analyst. Tovey took on this animateur role when he was offered the Reed Chair of Music at Edinburgh University in 1914. It's in this neoclassical role of the animateur, the helpful, active servant to music, that Tovey made his mark in music appreciation. Surprised at the high number of professional musicians in that city, he created, at the height of the war, the Reed Symphony Orchestra. In it he mixed female and male musicians, which ensured the hostility of the all-male Scottish orchestra over in Glasgow. From its first concert in 1917 until its last with Tovey in 1939, the Reed Orchestra gave 176 public concerts. The indefatigable Tovey conducted, or otherwise played the piano, in concertos, and for these concerts he wrote the famous programme notes. The printer, a fan of the professor, was often forced to take the cluttered script from Tovey's desk long after the deadline. These concerts were put on before the era of the Arts Council and public subsidy. Tovey was never paid, and indeed he set up a separate set of recitals at the Usher Hall in order to offset the losses of the Reed Orchestra. So during the concert season he would be playing in Edinburgh twice a week for free. The BBC broadcast some of these Reed concerts and the recitals, and so the listening public knew Tovey as a conductor and a pianist as much as a speaker. In fact, around 1935, the BBC nearly took over his orchestra. He had modelled it on the system he'd encountered in Germany and Holland of municipal orchestras. These orchestras served the local population in a variety of animateurish ways. But the BBC had created a new kind of model in 1930, that of a national orchestra, which could only exist because of radio. But the BBC Symphony Orchestra in London said it couldn't cope with the broadcasting workload set for it. So by 1935, the BBC was looking to the regions to fill the schedules. It considered inviting the Scottish Orchestra and the Reed to amalgamate into a BBC Scottish Orchestra. But its timing was dreadful. The Scottish National Party had risen up in 1934. It accused the BBC of taking Scottish licence money but doing nothing for Scotland with it. And there was then talk of a Scottish National Orchestra. The BBC said, "We already have a National Orchestra. It's in London." Tovey was keen to see a National Scottish Orchestra drawn from his players, but the Scottish Orchestra in Glasgow was hostile to any change. In the end, the BBC set up a new Scottish orchestra on top of the two Scottish orchestras. From that moment, the Reed Symphony Orchestra began the decline to its demise in the Second World War. Tovey himself did very well out of the BBC. He took over from Walford Davis the series Music and the Ordinary Listener in the early 30s. And Tovey did so at a time when the public was growing rather grumpy about the BBC's brazen attempts to educate and inform them. In 1927, the year that the BBC was made a public corporation, a Committee on Adult Education and Broadcasting had been set up under the ever-dependable Henry Haddo. His team suggested developments such as wireless listening groups. Out of this sprang the BBC's magazine The Listener, with its printed versions of broadcast talks. The number of listening groups peaked around 1933, but there was significant hostility too. A letter in the Radio Times ran,
"I read an announcement that over 100,000 listeners had applied for copies of your education syllabus. There are always 100,000 people idle enough to apply for a free gift. The curse of this busybody age is compulsory education, the haphazard pouring of ideas into minds that are neither inclined nor suited to receive them. For heaven's sake, leave people to find out for themselves instead of plugging them with second-hand culture. Alan Hickling, Kensington, W8.
Meanwhile, the BBC, in neoclassical fashion, had been heavily promoting the works of Bach. Among several letters of complaint came this from a Mr. Heap of Manchester. "The opinion of myself and my acquaintances is that Bach ought to have been drowned at birth. What is more, my set automatically switches itself off as soon as his name is mentioned." Another ran,
"Oh, John Sebastian, if only I could meet you in the flesh or the spirit and make you understand what I have suffered on your account. I do not understand you. I do not like you. Your sons, like wise men, lost their father's music, and all would have been well if some idiot hadn't found it."
Furthermore, radios Luxembourg, Normandy and the like started broadcasting in English highly popular dance music programmes on the very day, Sunday, when the BBC was at its most earnest and Reithian. So, it was in this challenging climate that Tovey made his warm-hearted, sprawling, shambling talks on Sunday afternoons, the once great pianist apologising as he struck the wrong keys for his gouty hands, actually arthritis. It was suggested that the public liked this professional for his amateurishness. Here's an example of him singing and playing appallingly the opening of the second section of Brahms' Requiem. Imagine you were sat on a Sunday afternoon having to listen to this. As Tovey grew ill and finally, deluded that he was Robert Schumann, unable to continue his public role, there was a gap in the provision of this Percy Scholes style popularising. Of course, there were other professors like Tovey in higher education whose contribution to music appreciation for the common folk was idiosyncratic but notable. Edward J. Dent was Tovey's opposite number at Cambridge. He was an out-and-out elitist who felt that some people had an innate understanding of music, while the only appreciation the others could have would be to appreciate that an elite got more out of music than they did. So Dent stood against those like Henry Haddo, who proposed schemes of formal training. Paradoxically, he stood closer to the socialist Scholes in making information about music, and music itself, accessible. An anarchist, an atheist, and openly gay, Dent was known as the Serpent. He certainly had an acid tongue, especially when vicars were around. But he got the name because he once appeared on stage before a Cambridge University production of The Magic Flute to announce a cast change. A little boy in the audience, who had clearly had the opera plot drilled into him, blurted out, "Mummy, is that the serpent?" Dent believed that opera had to be given in the local language so that everyone could understand the words, including little boys. He translated many operas, and some of his wittiest editions are still in use. As an effective governor of Sadler's Wells Opera, Dent propelled his vision that it should become not the National Opera of England, but the National English Opera, to emphasise the language. Next time you see an opera in English, or walk past the Colosseum, home of English National Opera, spare a thought for the serpent.
And Richard Witts continues his history of the music appreciation movement on Friday evening at 10:45. The producer in Bristol is Sarah Davis. It's 11 o'clock and now Late Junction with Max Reinhardt.
Thank you very much, James. Now, amongst the many delights of tonight's Late Junction, I'm featuring two bands from Africa who have quite a story wrapped around them. The first of them is Soto Sounds, shepherd musicians who started to play together while tending their livestock out in the hills of Lesotho, known as the Kingdom of the Sky because all of it lies at least 1,000 metres above sea level. Now, their instruments include guitars made from tin cans and brake cables. Their vocals embrace the Lesotho choral tradition. And their lucky break came when they were discovered and introduced to the world by Cotswold-based South African master percussionist Rizenga Makondo. This track is from their debut album, which hits the streets or wherever it is that new releases hit these days on October the 1st. Something to think about.
I want to Ha ben ekum teikum alde kanen dekum pundi hepen galakum smaline saloch grande. Ben ekum teikum alde kanen dekum pundi hepen galakum smaline saloch grande. Gini meken lene glan ken lene jalken lene glan. Gini meken lene glan smi palavende je marach. Gini meken lene glan ken lene jalken lene glan. Gini meken lene glan smi palavende je marach. Ben ekum teikum alde kanen dekum pundi hepen galakum. Kams malene saloch grande ben ekum teye kum halte kanen dekum pundi apen gala kams malene saloch grande gini meken lene glan ken lene gal ken lene glan gini meken lene glan smi palaven de je marach gini meken lene glan ken lene gal ken lene glan gini meken lene glan smi palaven de je marach. A fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, a fuel is Maria Rock and a hinger, a fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, a fuel is Maria Rock and a hinger, a fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, a fuel as a brick jorak upon a hinger, a fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, a fuel as a brick jorak upon a hinger, Maria Varag, 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 Maria Varag, Boningella Haravet, Maria Varag, 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 Maria Varag, Boningella Haravet, fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, fuel as a brick jorak upon a hinger, fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, fuel as a brick jorak upon a hinger, Maria Varag, 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 Maria Varag, Boningella Haravet, Maria Varag, 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 Maria Varag, Boningella Haravet, fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, fuel as a brick jorak upon a hinger, fuel liking it, a fuel liking it, fuel as a brick jorak upon a hinger.
That was a mini medley of Push Da Bail, or Mouth Music, sung by the extraordinary Catherine Ann McPhee from the island of Barra. Mouth music, by the way, is said to have originated as songs for dandling children or for dance tunes when no instruments were available. You can get in touch with us about mouth music or any other subject you deem relevant. Just tweet us at BBC Radio 3 or text 83111 or email lake.junction@bbc.co.uk while we're on air. I played some songs about inebriation last night, and you know what? I think I've got a taste for them now. This one's my first tonight. Honest it is. Kurt Vile and Bertolt Brecht's degenerate classic from Mahagoni, Alabama Song, as performed by Hungarian gypsy combo Budapest Bar. Listen out for the cymbalom.
Whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For we must find the next whiskey bar. Oh, if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Oh, moon of Alabama, it's time to say goodbye. We've lost a good old mama. I must have whiskey or you know why. Oh, moon of Alabama, it's time to say goodbye. We've lost a good old mama. I must have whiskey or you know why.
sure was the way to the next little girl. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For we must find the next little girl. Oh, if we don't find the next little girl, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Have little girl, oh, you know why. Oh, moon of Alabama, it's time to say goodbye. We've lost a good old mama. I must have little girl, oh, you know why. Oh, moon of Alabama, it's time to say goodbye. A dollar, oh, you know why. Oh, moon of Alabama, it's time to say our feelings in. We've lost a good old mama. I must have dollar, oh, you know why.